thing we have to fear is fear itself. Fear itself. Fear itself.
From the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University, this is Digital Campus, featuring Tom Scheinfeld, Mills Kelly, and Dan Cohen.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Fear itself.
This is Digital Campus number 53 for the 4th of March, 2010. Open and shut. And I'm back in the saddle. It's Dan Cohen reporting from the Center for History and New Media at George Mason University for the 53rd edition of the Digital Campus podcast. I'm here with regulars Tom Scheinfeld and Mills Kelly. Hi, Tom and Mills.
Hey.
Hey, Dan.
How's it going?
Good.
Thanks for...
Oh, well, I can actually see my entire yard now with no snow.
Oh, that's incredible. And thank you again for hosting last week or 2 weeks ago. We are here joined with one of our irregulars, Jeff McClurkin. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Dan.
Welcome back to the podcast. We're
Thanks
excited
for having
to
me
have you on again. And we're going to dig right in. I guess we'll just a little bit of an editor's update on Facebook and students and teachers, which we covered on Digital Campus number 52. We talked about a student being suspended for a Facebook page criticizing a teacher. And now we have the flip side of that. Evidently, a professor at East Strasbourg University being suspended for their Facebook posts, trying evidently with quite bad humor to hire a hitman. Mills, do you normally say that on Facebook?
You know, I normally
say
nothing
avoid that
of the kind on Facebook, nor do I say anything that hopefully anyone would take offense at. In fact, I try to be about as innocuous as possible. I think actually, so we had a student 2 weeks ago. This week we have a professor. So I guess in Digital Campus 54, we'll have university professors suspended for comments on Facebook.
Right. Can we get, there's a bunch of university presidents on there. Yeah, we could just get one of them to say something really idiotic.
Oh, that'd be juicy.
Or some kind of scandalous cell phone snapshot. I'm not sure what that would be.
Right. But, yeah. It does, I don't know the merits of this. I mean, I read the story in the Chronicle and, it sounds like a bad judgment on the part of the person who put these comments into Facebook. But really, it raises, I think, an important issue, which is this that we've talked about before, which is this blurring of the line between someone's public persona as a professor or an administrator or a librarian and their private life. And so people, I think, in Facebook often have a hard time making that distinction between public and private. And so something that, certainly if every teacher and professor who said they wanted to, whack their students over the head one day, if they all got fired, well, school would be closed because at some point in everybody's career, we want to clunk a student for whatever reason. And we might even repeat that desire to a colleague standing in front of the coffee maker or whatever. And okay, it's just a way of letting off steam and it's not serious. But when you post it online, then it becomes public knowledge, public property, and in this case, apparently actionable.
Yeah.
So I think, I think this is a problem that's going to be with us for a while, is people having a hard time making this distinction between their public and private lives.
Right. And, again, picking up from last week, we were discussing the increasing prodding by these services, like new services like Google Buzz and Facebook, in their new privacy settings of sort of trying to make as much as possible public, often without the knowledge of the people who are posting. And I could see more and more cases of this happening. Well, obviously,
that's actually particularly relevant here because apparently in this case, you know, part of her concern, the defense this professor has offered is that, in fact, she didn't realize that other people could see it beyond her sort of immediate circle of family and friends. And so, again, we're back at questions of privacy and understanding the privacy settings of some of these social media networks.
Yeah, this is a really great question. I mean, I know that we're formulating a social media policy here on our campus, and I assume one of the bullet points is going to have to be something like, make the assumption that everything you post online will be read by everyone. Because, you know, you've got to be really paying attention to make sure that you've got everything being sent to the proper group or things like that. So very tricky, very, very tricky. Okay, well, it's been a while since we've had our legal segment of the podcast. Do we have our legal music? Where do I cue that up here in the Digital Campus audio dashboard? Oh, thank you there, Tom. Yes, we need some kind of Perry Mason music. Seems like everyone's suing each other now. And while this isn't this week in law, I suppose it is something that we should discuss in terms of Apple suing HTC, the cell phone handset maker who makes a lot of Android phones. And so they're sort of indirectly suing the Android operating system, which we've talked a lot about, over multi-touch and a bunch of related user interface issues. And then Facebook somehow got a patent on the news feed, which is quite remarkable. Of course, earlier on, Apple had already sued Nokia, and I think Nokia had sued Apple.
It's counter
mutual suing. Yes, and I guess the angle here for campuses and museums and libraries is that I was thinking about being worthy of discussing is, you know, we've talked a lot about on this podcast of the utility of these handsets for let's say a museum tour. Right now, the Cooper Hewitt Museum in New York, for instance, has a design exhibit where they give you an iPod Touch with part of the exhibit is actually on the iPod Touch and you use it as you walk around. And I'm sort of wondering here if these lawsuits are actually effective. Are we going to have trouble, for instance, will Apple suddenly have a monopoly on multi-touch items or classroom clickers or devices for going out to Civil War battlefields? Are we going to end up with single suppliers if this is taken to its logical extreme? Is this something we should be worried about at all, or just is it crazy legal maneuverings?
I think there's some worry. I mean, the hope is, right, that they're all just kind of trying to stake out their little bits of real estate in these new markets, and that once sort of clear leaders in various markets emerge, and you know, everybody sort of settles on a certain amount of market share in these different domains, you know, everything will be better. I mean, I do think that the worry is that, you know, institutions will invest in a particular technology that then will that investment then will become obsolete if a certain service is forced to be closed down. I mean, one of the things that another one of these patents is Google has patented location-based advertising, and so that in many ways, I think, you know, Apple has recently bought a company that does location-based advertising. I think a lot of these people, a lot of these groups see advertising as one of the business models. If Google gets a monopoly essentially on location-based advertising, so basically cell phone advertising, then it pushes a lot of other potential competition, other players out of the market. And, you know, if you have settled on iPhone as your platform, or you've settled on Palm, I don't know who has, as your platform, it could create problems down the road if those other players, smaller players especially, get pushed out of the market. So, I think there's competition in technology is good for everybody. And to the extent that these patents, which are seem to me to be, you know, in many cases overly broad, if these patents limit competition, I don't think that's good for the creative people working in technology, higher ed, museums and libraries.
yet. Mills, what do you think about this? Or Jeff, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay, well, just it seems to me that they're that a lot of these patents are written so broadly that some are clearly going to have to be tested in court. And I think we'll have to wait and see what happens with that. But I also think that, in part, these patents are about trying to sort of be able to charge other people for these things. So maybe Google, you know, licenses location-based advertising to others, and it's a way for them to make money, and the big companies will find ways to make that work. They'll negotiate, I think, in most cases, because the goal is to make money. But I also wonder what that means for sort of smaller companies or startups, or, I mean, if you end up with sort of all of the different pieces of the market being sort of occupied by these big companies who may be able to work out relationships with each other, that's one thing. But if you're shutting out, you know, colleges or universities who might not be able to pay those fees or work out those deals, I think we really are looking at some potential shutdown of innovation in some of the places that you're most likely to see it. So it's a concern.
Yeah, my worry is really for, you know, small museums, small colleges, organizations without the resources to either A, investigate what they can do within the limits of the copyright and patents, and so therefore, and being risk averse, just therefore won't do anything, and so it exerts this kind of chilling effect, or B, just will will try to do something and then get stepped on all of a sudden by, you know, someone trolling for patent violations, copyright violations. So I'm especially concerned about the little guy, because I think so much interesting work in the digital humanities is taking place, especially in small museums, historical societies, you know, really small organizations with virtually no resources, but a lot of entrepreneurial spirit. And they're the ones I worry about the most. I'm not as worried about the big universities the big cultural institutions who are in a position to actually exert their rights. And it's the little guy that I'm really worried about in this situation.
Hard to know, isn't it, whether, you know, you should spend the time, let's say, to write a multi-touch museum application for Android. I mean, I assume part of the reason Apple is doing this is just to inject some uncertainty into the process, isn't it?
I think so. I mean, it would make sense if I were the chairman of Apple, it would make sense for me to make sense to me to do that, to create this kind of uncertainty.
Yeah. You know, I think kind of related issue is, the question of history and, how we can maintain all these tools in a very difficult IP environment. We saw there was a great article, which again we'll link to on the post for this podcast. Increasingly, it's just becoming harder and harder to kind of function in this as an academic in this environment to do things like, you know, archiving, let's say, video games or Second Life environments. I was saying a little bit earlier when we were off the air that there was a great sort of story about trying to archive a scene from Second Life and all the intellectual property rules that impinged upon that act of trying to save that environment. And part of it included trying to get in touch with all the avatars who wandered through the scene, which evidently was about 100 avatars. And I guess this professor had emailed, or I don't know what you do in Second Life, but I guess direct message them, and only 11 people responded, and most of them said no. And so how do you actually save these things? I wonder if there's going to be kind of similar sorts of IP problems across the board, or just the threat of that, Mills, as you said, that you just can't function in this environment.
Well, I think, it's interesting. I think we've become used to, in the 15 years of the World Wide Web, I think we've become used to sort of the openness of the web and the fact that you can kind of come and go from anywhere on the web that you like with relative ease. And, you know, I, and we talked about this on you know, several episodes ago, but I think we're seeing more and more these kind of walled gardens spring up again on the web, where, you know, Second Life, Facebook, these other places where, you know, it's not very easy to come and go on those places. You know, partially technologically, they tend to lock your content down, but partially for IP reasons as well, where the ownership of the material that you're creating and posting is not necessarily clear cut. It's not clear cut to the person who's posting it and to who's participating on the service. And so, you know, that is problematic for cultural institutions and higher education institutions of higher education who, you know, want to do these kind of open education initiatives, but they're doing them in these maybe less than open places, these services on the web that I think, you know, people sort of assume are more open than they, you know, actually legally, and that the terms of service and the EULAs and everything else that then they say, you know, people click through the licenses when they sign up for a Facebook account, and you don't really know what you're, you know, what are you giving to Facebook, and what do you retain yourself? So, you know, I think it is a problem with these walled garden services, and I think people need to be, you know, careful when they're institutions need to be careful when they're putting valuable human resources and time commitments into building content in these resources, in these walled gardens. I think it's something we all should be aware of moving forward.
Right. I mean, it seems like this is part of the debate over the iPad, isn't it? That on the one hand, I think a lot of us are cheering Steve Jobs for pushing back against Flash, which really is a kind of, I mean, do we really think anything that operates in Flash is going to be usable in 10 years or archivable in 10 or 100 years? You know, even Flash itself is changing from version to version. So it's already a terrible, non-standard, non-open environment. So that's on the one hand. The iPad says, well, wait a second, you know, you've got a web browser, maybe you can use HTML5, you can use modern open standards. But on the other hand, you know, you make an app for the iPad, it is a kind of, once again, I mean, a dedicated app is a, rather than a web browser-based app, it's, again, a kind of walled garden situation. So there are a lot more of these decisions that we have to make now, aren't there?
Yeah, and I think people we're probably doing some of the same things, but I probably shouldn't throw stones, but I think institutions are making decisions based on, you know, it seems like things are moving very quickly right now, and that new platforms and new services are popping up very, very quickly, and people are making decisions about where to put their, you know, sort of technology, content creation resources, where to put these things without maybe thinking through the longer term implications of those choices. You know, when you choose to build an iPhone app, you know, what does that mean for you know, for the sustainability of the project? What does that mean for the ownership of the code and the content? What does that mean for you know, the range of people who are going to be able to use that resource? You know, it's the cool new thing, or same thing with it. If you build an Android app, or a Flash application, or if you put a lot of time and effort into building up a social network on Twitter or Facebook, if your institution has done that, you know, where are you pouring that value? And really, can you get that value back out when it's time, when you want to? And that, you know, I think we're all doing this, and I think we all need to be careful of, you know, make those decisions with those questions in mind.
But I think that could also explain some of the litigation frenzy that's going on at the moment, because with the kind of accelerating rate of new technologies, new platforms, I think a lot of corporations are probably saying, this might get away from us, and so therefore we've got to stake out our piece of this now, of the existing pie now, And because who knows what it's going to look like a year from now, 2 years from now. And so that's one possible explanation for where we started with this discussion.
Well, I wonder where this leaves us in terms of camp, the digital campus, because, you know, I mean, you all know that decisions in the academic realm are not made on the same time scale that decisions in the technological realm are. And so, you know, in order to make a decision to go to embrace a particular system often takes, you know, 18 months and five committees. But, you know, I just wonder if we're at this point where this had this fundamental disconnect between the culture of the campus and the culture of the technology, and what that means for the results in how we embrace or not embrace these particular technologies. I think people are sort of dipping into things and trying things briefly, but they're not really ultimately investing heavily in it because they're afraid they're going to get burned.
Right. It really is a tough situation right now, too, in terms of, you know, how do you maximize your creativity while also maximizing your openness and sustainability? It seems like those three things are currently, I mean, especially as we look at all these lawsuits and patents getting filed and used, and also just the rapid change of technology that we've always had. I'm not sure how you make clear decisions right now about paths forward. You know, let's say you're a university press. Do you commit to EPUB, for instance, which is an open standard? It can have DRM on it. It runs on a bunch of things, but it doesn't run on the Kindle. Or do you commit to the Kindle? You know, I mean, obviously you can do more than one thing at a time, but then you're, you know, sort of dividing up your resources and you have to maintain multiple platforms. You know, do you try to use the, you know, I just saw it just today, Penguin Group, the big publishers, decided to really go in full on iPad ebooks because they feel like they're going to add a lot more value. They can have video in them. They were showing some kids' books that are, you know, really colorful and in a way that obviously that the Kindle can't do. So they're saying, okay, well, we're going to commit as a publisher to the iPad platform. You know, and those books will not be able to be easily repurposed to the Kindle or the Sony Reader. And it just seems like the possibility of us getting pigeonholed in these devices is becoming much more perilous, isn't it?
I think it's absolutely more perilous, and it's why I have such high hopes, I think, for HTML5. That it will allow a lot of these interactions, a lot of the richness of Flash, a lot of the speed and the dynamism of native iPhone and Android applications to return back to the browser, which is, I think, a much more open. The potential for openness is much greater in the browser than, you know, anywhere else in the technology ecosystem. And I'm really hoping that, you know, ultimately, you know, the Penguin books on the iPad will be Penguin books on Safari on the iPad, not Penguin books in an iPhone app or in the iPad reader application. So I have these, you know, and maybe outsized hopes for the new open standards coming down the pike. I think we'll have to see, but that's, I think, our best hope is that these closed content services, these closed systems, these closed technologies are bested by open standards, open systems, open services that that provide as good or better of an experience.
Yeah, I mean, I guess though, even when you make a decision to use those open standards, you are effectively saying, you know, well, I'm going to limit myself in some ways, you know, and that's, I think, the tough part right now is to say.
Well, a lot of times it's a business. You're limiting your business models.
Right, right. That's true.
Right? Like if you commit to openness, well, then you're basically saying, well, you know, I don't want the kind of built-in business model that Apple provides me, that the Apple iBook store, you know, is going to provide me. You know, like Apple's giving you the sustainability. They're giving you the business model. Whereas the open standard's like, well, it's like find your own business model.
Right. Okay. I think yeah. I think we need to talk more about that in just a second. But just on this point, Jeff and Mills, what is your thought? I mean, if you were trying to balance these things out, I mean, I'm sure that once we have the shiny iPad in our hands, we're going to want to do things on it. Will you make conscious decisions to say, well, you know, I'm going to use an HTML5 app, even though I can't do multi-touch on it. I can't do some of the things that Flash, for instance, can do. Are you willing to give things up for in this trade-off that we've imagined here?
Yeah, it's a good problem to point to, because on the one hand, I'm pretty enthusiastic about what the iPad might be able to do for some of the teaching problems I'm up against. And you know, I can be overcome by techno lust like anybody. And so it's that is a definite possibility that I might. And also it's, you know, okay, I have the advantage of working at George Mason and being part of the Center for History and New Media. And so I can actually go the other way and say, you know, I can develop these open things because I can, there are lots of people I can ask questions where if I don't have any of that kind of support behind me, I'm probably going to follow the path of least resistance, especially if that path of least resistance is paved with iPads.
Right. How about you, Jeff? I mean, University of Mary Washington, where you are, has really pioneered the use of really fully open platforms. Do you think that they would just reject out of hand, let's say, a program where they're going to stick iPads in everyone's hands and use very specifically iPad-ish kinds of applications for the classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are certainly people at Mary Washington who have really pushed open source and openly available software for financial reasons, because we haven't been able to invest, we haven't had the resources to invest in iPod touches or Kindles or anything like that, and so our innovation has come in other ways. But there are also people who pretty strongly believe in. Believe in being as open as possible, and really do have some problems with the closed nature of the iPad. But again, I think I'm in a similar position as Mills in that I have a group of people in teaching and learning technologies at Mary Washington who are really interested in innovating as much as possible in new and creative ways and looking for ways to do that don't require heavy investment in a closed system. I mean, in some ways, using something like UMW Blogs, it doesn't really cost the institution that much for us to experiment in a variety of ways. With any of these things, though, we're making choices, right? I mean, what's our priority? If we get past our techno lust, which is no easy thing, let me be clear. but if we get past our techno lust, right, we're making choices about what it is we're trying to do with these things in and outside of the classroom. And if what we're trying to do is, you know, provide some kind of seamless experience, if we're trying to minimize some of the sort of headache of the open web, you know, the Apple iPad offers some really compelling sort of user experiences. Now the question is whether those user experiences are transformative enough or innovative enough or different enough from what we can get in other ways that it's worth the investment in resources, human and technical resources, to go that way. So I don't think I answered your question, Dan.
No, I think you did better than I could express it. So, I mean, I guess thinking about the ends is really the key point here, isn't it, rather than the means to get there. So I think thinking about, and it may be that, let's say, some teaching applications are different than, you know, other kinds of applications that you would have on these things. Well, let's get to Tom's point, which I bracketed earlier, about, you know, these other considerations about financial sustainability. In HTML5. I mean, if you go ahead and release a un-DRM'd EPUB to the web if you're a publisher. That can just get passed around and put on any device or any device that reads EPUB, which is everything except the Kindle at this point. You're a software developer and you just put things out as HTML5 widgets that can run in any browser and works on any of these devices, and forego the chance to get your 70 cents on the dollar from the Apple App Store or from the Android App Store. What about this choice and the difficulty? I mean, this was certainly raised, as we saw in the past week, by the attempt of more than a dozen universities to prop up OpenCourseWare, the open source, it's a consortium of universities that puts together an open source application to put lecture videos, assignments, and syllabi on the web. And, you know, has run into some problems. I think we discussed it on Digital Campus number 51. I think one of the original OCW campuses decided to kind of get rid of it for cost reasons, because even though it was free, they had to maintain it and you know, have systems to run it and people to run it. And just this last week, there were a dozen universities that put together $350,000 to support the OpenCourseWare Consortium and to try to continue the funding for this. What about these questions of sustainability once you do get into open source and open access? We haven't really discussed this much on the podcast, but I suppose that with these devices that are getting a little bit more laden with intellectual property and the urge to really avoid intellectual property problems and going to open standards, doesn't that create the problem of, you know, getting rid of the main source of sustainability, which is fee for service or fee for software? Tom, what do you think about these issues? I know you've thought a lot about this.
Yeah,
you started talking about it earlier. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't think that there are really easy answers to this. I think there. Business models for open source software and business models for open content projects are, they're few and far between. I mean, I think you can point to some successes, but I think, those successes usually, if you look a little deeper, there are some, sort of fairly specific circumstances that lend themselves to success in that case. And, those models often, the models aren't always transferable. For instance, Mozilla is kind of the classic example. Like, Mozilla is totally sustainable and Firefox is completely sustainable, but it's only sustainable because it provides, huge amounts of search traffic to Google through its search bar, and then it gets a few cents back on every click,
right, which adds up to tens of millions of dollars a year for it.
So sustainability, but how is that transferable to, our open source projects, Omeka and Zotero? We can't put a Google search box in our, it just doesn't work for us. So I think that these models are not well established. It's an ongoing problem. At the same time, I guess I'd say there are some very attractive alternatives popping up in things like the iBook store, where people see, I could just, sell them through Apple. Apple handles all of that all that problematic marketing and, distribution and everything, and I get money back. But then so it's not just that you're closing things off. It's also that you're giving Apple an awful lot of power over your markets and over your customer base and over your marketing and over your product and your lifeline, so that even the kind of more commercial sustainability models that are out there have their problems. I think it's a tough time. I think this issue of sustainability, anybody who thinks they have easy answers to this question, I think should look a little closer.
Yeah, Jeff, how does UMW sustain, for instance, the WordPress multi-user installation that runs your campus-wide blogging system and all the associated, do you have Blackboard or anything like that?
We have Blackboard.
Okay.
Well, I mean,
how are the open source pieces sustained compared to, let's say, Blackboard?
Well, I mean, if you talk about the amount of resources that go into them, Blackboard is significantly more expensive.
Sure.
I mean, I don't have exact numbers in front of me, but the cost of sustaining UMW blogs is effectively the hosting fees and the work that people like Jim Groom and Martha Burtis and others do in supporting it. And so, you know, I mean, it's actually a remarkably inexpensive thing, certainly compared to a massive course management system like Blackboard is. You know, and that's something that we're sort of constantly talking about as an institution is, you know, what role does a corporate CMS or LMS like Blackboard play, and what ways in some ways can something like UMW blogs substitute for that, supplement that? I mean, I think it's in part because we've been able to, use sweat equity on the part of some of the people who really care about it. We've been able to make UMW blogs work for a lot less than it might cost to sustain it at another place. I would say, though, that I think in some ways the question of sustainability, and when we think of things like open courseware and these institutions who are ponying up, apparently not enough to fully support it, but ponying up money to support this consortium, you know, what's happening there in some ways is that rather than focusing their attention on just their own internal infrastructure, I think these colleges and universities are recognizing that that there's a larger infrastructure that goes beyond their campus that they're willing to invest in. And in that way, if it becomes part of your infrastructure support and it becomes part of the decisions you make about infrastructure support, I think we have to sort of change in some ways the way we think about infrastructure. We're used to thinking for hundreds of years about infrastructure on a college campus as fundamentally being about the buildings. Our technology infrastructure is becoming more disaggregated than I think any of us have ever expected. So I think there's another way to think about that.
Right. Mills, where do you come down on this? I mean, it seems to me like Jeff is sort of talking about sometimes these costs are just sort of folded into the general. I mean, there's not direct costs. In other words, you're not paying Blackboard $50,000 a year or whatever the cost is, but you just sort of sink the cost of running the blogs into the sweat equity of several faculty and educational technology staff, maybe the IT unit. What's your thought on how to sustain these things? I mean, it was pretty remarkable in this story about OpenCourseWare that the consortium itself has a budget of $750,000 a year,
which is
a very high end. I mean, that's a lot of money of direct cost to sustain the software and the project.
Right. You know, I have to say, I completely agree with what Jeff just said about the investment in a relatively limited amount of human capital to do some very interesting things like they've done at Mary Washington. The cost, I think the cost is probably the same or less to do it the way that Mary Washington has done it as opposed to the way that George Mason has done it, which is to invest in first WebCT and now, you know, Blackboard when they merge, because the staffing required to keep Blackboard up and stable is pretty significant. There are a fair number of people on our campus whose most of their job time is tasked to making that platform work. And then there's the cost of actually licensing Blackboard. So never mind my negative opinion of course management systems in general. I'm just thinking about the cost factors. I think it's probably less expensive to go the route that Mary Washington has gone, but more complicated. You know, I mean, you have to have good people. One of the reasons that they've been able to do what they've been able to do is not just that they made an institutional commitment to it and that they're paying people to do it, but they're paying really good people to do it. And so they've been fortunate to get really good people who are willing to work for less money than they could make in, you know, working in the tech sector generally to accomplish some very interesting and exciting things on their campus. So I think at CH&M we've been successful hiring people in much the same way. So those people are out there. And so I think, from a purely cost perspective, it's probably cheaper but a little more difficult to go the way that they've gone. That said, I think that universities really should be doing that, because doing what Mary Washington has done, because universities are supposed to be places of innovation, not places that are just purchasing products that are for sale from other people. You know, one of our roles as a sector of, you know, if you want to say what's our sector of the economy, well, innovation is our sector. And that's, you know, if we don't do anything else to contribute to the larger economy other than training workers in some way, we're constantly engaged in the business of innovation, either on our own or in partnership with local businesses or global businesses. And so if we just lock ourselves into buying off-the-shelf products, then that stifles innovation in a sector that's supposed to be about innovation. So that's, I have a sort of a philosophical problem for higher education buying these kinds of packages.
But you're right, Mills. It's just so much easier to,
oh sure,
you know, to buy something off the shelf than to, you know, invest. It's real, and it really is. It's investing in people. You know, people are, you know, like, I get a lot of questions about how to budget for digital projects, and people are, you know, often surprised that, like, the budgets for our projects, it's all staff time. You know, I mean, like,
right, sure,
you know, like, there's, you know, there's a little bit of equipment on the fringes and a little bit of, you know, other, you know, things here and there. But I mean, it's all, our budgets are entirely staff time. You know, and that, and it's hard to, you know, people are very rare, administrators, people, decision makers are wary of making, you know, hiring commitments. That's a much scarier thing to do than to just, you know, buy a product.
And also if you
be done with it when you don't want it anymore.
I mean, if you buy the product, then the vendor has, you know, all these things that they offer, you know, training programs for your staff to go to. So they'll do all the startup training and, you know, so the lead time is less. But then, you know, nothing new or interesting comes out of that. Except that, okay, we're another Blackboard site. Oh boy. You know, it's just, it doesn't lead anywhere.
Right, right. Well, let me switch gears just for a final story here. Jeff, I just realized you taught a course on TED Talks, didn't you?
I did, yeah.
Yeah. Can I hear a little bit about that since we've got you on the line? This is my cheap way of hijacking
I'd like
podcast.
And also.
No, I mean, I'm just curious, but as I'm giving a TEDx talk.
You're scared that you're giving a talk on
Saturday. Yeah, I'm giving a junior varsity TED talk this weekend up in New York.
So tell Dan what he should say.
Yeah, what am I saying again? And I have the awful slot of, you know, having to go after Larry Lessig and, you know, Henry Jenkins and Jay Rosen and all these people who I'm sure will give far better talks than me. But I'm kind of curious about this because I think it also blends into some of the things that certainly, Mills, you've talked about on the podcast of trying to be a little bit more creative about course teaching with media. And all these TED Talks are available. Could you just, for people who don't know in the podcast, sure, what TED is and why you decided to use it in the class and how their TED videos helped out?
Sure. TED is stands for Technology Entertainment Design, and it's a conference that's been going on out in California for 25, 30 years now. But within the last few years, they've begun to make these TED Talks, and they come from all people from sort of all walks of life, but people who are, you know, inventors of, you know, scientists, researchers, inventors, political leaders, and they have in the standard format 18 minutes to talk, to present their life's work in 18 minutes. And it really sort of focuses on, you know, presenting ideas to a packed audience. A few years ago, TED.com was created as a site that would really allow them to present these talks, and they're freely available. And so a colleague of mine at Mary Washington and I have been talking, sort of sharing TED Talks back and forth for a while. And so we said, we really should do a class on this. And so what we did was create a first-year seminar that was based around TED Talks. And the students all came in, and they helped us write the syllabus, and the first few weeks of class, and then they would lead discussions. Two students would lead discussion on a theme, and they would find, so it might be, you know, the coming end of the world was one of the themes. And so they had to look at all the ways that the sort of all the TED Talks that had something to do with the end of the world. And then they would present on it, and everybody would watch these TED Talks, and we'd have discussions, and they would post on the blog before and after their comments. And then at the end of the semester, they did their own TED Talks, where they talked about something that they were truly passionate about. And all that stuff's available online, actually. It's TED2009@umwblogs.org. So all the TED Talks are available that they did, and all the TED Talks that they used over the course of the semester. But the basic idea was about sort of presenting one's idea in a passionate and persuasive way. So
that's really great. I'll have to check that out, and we'll again link to that TED2009 site in your course. And it worked out well then. The course.
It did. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it was it really sort of pushed the students. And I mean, these were first semester freshmen at Mary Washington, and so it was an eye opening course for them, because in some ways, them helping us to write the syllabus. We talked about what education was and how it mattered, and there are lots of great TED Talks about education for them to get started on. But it was a good start to their collegiate careers.
Right. Where I felt like this course sort of overlapped with some of the things we discussed on the podcast is just, you know, we've talked about podcasting lectures, and it's just doing this TED Talk, writing it, for me, it made me think a lot about teaching as theater. Which is not necessarily a negative thing.
Right.
So, you know, it's often the way that people learn is, you know, by having jokes inserted into lectures, or to have surprising things inserted. And then I also like the succinctness of it. It's a tough form to do, but I think if done right, you can get across a lot more in 18 minutes, which is the strict limit they've given
right.
me, than these longer things, huh? Well, thanks, Jeff, for joining us on the podcast. Really appreciate
sure.
your insights on so many things. And you're available at Jay McClurkin on the Twitter. and your blog address again? We'll link to it from
McClurkin.org.
McClurkin.org. Wow.
Yeah.
Right, you're responsible for the worldwide McClurkin clan then?
I've actually gotten some emails from other McClurkins who are a little frustrated by my appropriating of that. But there aren't that many of us, so I've negotiated that out.
And you know, you could always sell the domain if they want it that bad.
That's right. I'm
you
sure
can
it'll
license
go
their name back to them.
Yeah, it'll
That's
go
right.
for more than sex.com, I'm sure,
in
open auction. Mills Kelly is not available on Twitter. Only his fake. Really, a paler version of Mills Kelly is available at Ed Wired on Twitter. But really, the real Mills Kelly is found at edwired.org, his terrific blog on technology and education. Thanks, Mills.
Sure.
And Tom Scheinfeld, of course, is at Found History and foundhistory.org. Thanks, Tom.
Great to talk to you guys.
The only thing we have to fear is
Please visit us online at digitalcampus.tv, where you can join in the discussion and let us know about stories and issues you would like us to cover on future episodes. Mike O'Malley wrote our theme music.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. Thank you.